Hi, I'm Doug Blackwood. I've been your happy host of Seems Like Old Times for about 18 years on CFRU 93.3 FM. There have been a few changes in the show. It still has those great old radio programs from the 1930s to 50s with music memories to match, but there have also been more features and interviews on subjects that we feel would be of benefit to listeners. From war memories to health issues for older adults, we know you'd be interested. You'll hear it. Seems Like Old Times, Wednesdays from 2 to 4 p.m. on CFRU 93.3 FM.
It is no surprise that one of CFRU's longest-running and most popular programs is Clan na Gael. We feature 2 hours of the best Celtic music from around the world and around the corner. Listen on Sundays after the BBC World News at noon. Tune in and get your fill of fiddles, whistles, banjos, mandolins, barons, harps, flutes, and wonderful voices. And of course, let's not forget everyone's favorite Celtic musical instrument, the bagpipes. Clan na Gael is the most bagpipe-friendly show on CFRU FM 93.3. Join me, John Fahey, on Sundays and start your own Celtic Kitchen Ceilidh.
You're listening to Terra Informa, a syndicated environmental news program produced at CJSR in Edmonton, Alberta. Stay tuned to CFRU 93.3 FM in Guelph.
You're tuned in to Terra Informa, your source for environmental news. I'm your host, Rebecca Rooney, and I'll be guiding you through the next half hour of environmental news. Today, we take a look at the controversial anti-whaling group Sea Shepherd. Then we hear from renowned water scientist Dr. David Schindler on his research into pollution of the Athabasca River by the Alberta tar sands industry. But first, here is our rapid-fire news attack, where we sum up the week's top environmental news stories, brought to you this week by Steve Anderson and Dana Harper.
I'm Dana Harper.
And I'm Steve Anderson.
And this is your wrap-up of the week's environmental news headlines. The federal government has a new air and water quality monitoring plan for the Alberta oil sands. Environment Minister Peter Kent announced the initiative last week.
Industry is expanding production. And with its environmental footprint, we need evidence that the growing production is environmentally responsible.
The plan comes in response to recommendations made last year by an independent advisory panel. It aims to both increase the number of monitoring locations and to improve measurement of negative impacts downwind and downstream of oil sands operations. Implementing the plan is expected to cost approximately $50 million per year for the next few years, declining over time, and these costs will be paid by industry. Critics, though, are skeptical as so far the regulations from the plan are not legally binding and seem to emphasize data collection rather than mitigation.
The oil sands may be getting more attention from Environment Canada in coming years, but other industrial projects are set to receive far less oversight. Planning documents show that funding for the Canadian Environmental Assessment Agency will be slashed by 43% next year. In response, the agency is preparing to reduce its staffing by a third, and the program responsible for consulting with First Nations communities will be shut down entirely. Opposition parties and environmental groups are raising alarms over the move. They warn that with a long list of major resource extraction projects on the horizon, gutting the agency responsible for environmental assessments will put our air, water, and biodiversity at risk.
To British Columbia now, a proposal for an open-pit mine approximately 65 kilometers northeast of Smithers is in the public consultation phase. Pacific Booker Minerals Incorporated would extract copper and gold from the mine. The Canadian Environmental Assessment Agency and British Columbia's Environmental Assessment Office are working together to ensure that adequate public consultation takes place. Pacific Booker has submitted information on all potential environmental effects for the project. Public comments will be taken from July 27th through August 10th.
This past week saw yet another oil pipeline rupture. The leak was detected early last Tuesday morning in the Pembina pipeline northwest of Edmonton. An estimated 1,300 barrels of oil escaped into the surrounding muskeg and a nearby creek. This follows a larger oil spill in Alberta in late April, a leak in the Northwest Territories in May, and a spill in Montana downstream from the Yellowstone National Park on July 1st.
Ontario's Environmental Review Tribunal decided this week to support the approval of the Kent Breeze Wind Project, which is being developed by Suncor Energy. This project is the first to be approved under the Green Energy Act. The Canadian Wind Energy Association applauds this decision as it agrees with, quote, the balance of expert scientific and medical information, which clearly indicates there is no direct link between wind turbines and effects on human health, end quote. Construction began late last year, but opponents of the project state the potential negative human health impacts as reasons against the project. However, Ontario is said to have one of the most stringent wind turbine standards in North America.
The Dene Nation has formally expressed its support for the First Nations of BC who are opposing the Northern Gateway Pipeline. The 35 chiefs of Denendeh, which encompasses Northern Alberta and all of the Northwest Territories, passed the resolution last week. Dene National Chief Bill Erasmus said that more than half of the proposed pipeline and tanker route passes through the territories of First Nations that oppose the project. He went on to say that the pipeline will enable the expansion of the Alberta tar sands, which are contaminating northern waterways. That's it for your rapid-fire news attack. Back to you, Rebecca.
Thanks, guys. You're listening to Terra Informa, heard from coast to coast on stations like CFIS in Prince George, UMFM in Winnipeg, and CKDU in Halifax. If there's a story in your community that we should be covering, send us an email at terra@cjsr.com. A dangerous and high-stakes game of cat and mouse is played out every Antarctic summer season. The Japanese whaling fleet partakes in an annual hunt of approximately 1,000 whales, but it's not alone in the Southern Oceans. Hot in Pursuit is an environmental group called Sea Shepherd. A new documentary chronicling the life of Sea Shepherd's founder has just been released, titled Eco Pirate, The Story of Paul Watson. So, for anyone who's thinking about seeing the film, we thought we'd give you a little background. This is a piece that David Karchin put together on Sea Shepherd last year, shortly after they lost a high-speed trimaran to a collision with a whaling ship.
A dramatic confrontation has evolved into a permanent fixture of the Antarctic summer season. The Japanese whaling fleet undertakes an annual hunt in the Southern Ocean despite international pressure to desist. Their actions are opposed directly by a high-profile environmental group, the Sea Shepherd. The conflict is real and dangerous. Last week, a collision occurred between a 6-man high-speed jet boat operated by Sea Shepherd and a 500-ton Japanese harpoon ship. Although no personnel were killed, there were some injuries, and the $2 million jet boat sunk into the icy Antarctic depths. Who caused the accident is the matter of intense debate between the Japanese whalers and the activists, and both have filed complaints with international maritime authorities. Despite the obvious danger, both sides appear determined to continue their respective missions. In this story, Terra Informa peers deep into this long-running saga. Why do the Japanese persist with their unpopular hunt? Who are these well-funded eco-warriors, and have they had any impact? Does international law have anything to say about whaling? These are but a handful of the unknowns in this dramatic and violent confrontation in one of the most hostile environments on the planet. Take 200 grams of whale meat, cut into small, bite-sized cubes and marinate in a mixture of soy sauce and sake. Coat the cubes with katakuri, water chestnut powder, and fry in oil with whole green peppers for about 30 seconds. When golden brown, drain the oil, then serve with seasonal vegetables and lemon wedges to garnish. This recipe comes from the cookbook Mrs. Onishi's Whale Cuisine, and this dish and others can be bought for high prices at restaurants across Japan. But supplies are limited these days, and it's only popular with a small number of Japanese. Anti-whaling groups claim that the country is no more a nation of whale eaters than ours is a country of quail eaters. This may well be the case, but there is a large section of the Japanese population
that is equally opposed to Western hostility towards their country's whaling operations, what they call cultural imperialism. Certainly, whaling is not new. It has been practiced extensively by civilizations and modern states for at least 6,000 years and for at least 5,000 years in Japan. Indigenous communities in Canada, Greenland, Alaska, the Caribbean, the Philippines, and Indonesia all undertake small-scale, non-profit whaling operations and are permitted to do so by the International Whaling Commission. Salted whale blubber could be bought in medieval French villages in the 9th century. Industrial whaling in the 19th century by England, the Netherlands, and the United States supplied candles, streetlight fuel, and machine lubricant. In fact, the discovery of mineral oil in the 20th century has probably done more for the cause of whales than any inflatable boat filled with protesters. Commercial whaling was banned in 1986 by the International Whaling Commission as the large species hovered on the brink of extinction. Today, numbers have improved somewhat, yet most of the big species are still listed as endangered. But back to the events in the Southern Ocean. The collision between the Sea Shepherd jet boat and the Harpoon ship was just one of a number of dramatic occurrences this year. Both sides are well armed. Mounted on the front of the Sea Shepherd's flagship is a hydraulic steel ram called the Can Opener, designed specifically to damage whaling ships. The Sea Shepherd has notched up a fearsome 10 sinkings in their 33 years of operation. They also use powerful stink bombs, organic and biodegradable of course, which are hurled onto the decks of the whaling ships trying to butcher their kill. On the whaler's side are long-range sirens, loud enough to send protesters scurrying for cover. Water cannons are used to blast the decks of their adversary ships and to repel inflatable boats. More worryingly is the prospect of an accident involving one of the grenade-tipped harpoons. Hence, it's a high-stakes business. But who are the Sea Shepherd, and are they eco-terrorists or valiant warriors for justice? That, of course, depends on who you ask. Both the Japanese Fisheries Agency and Sea Shepherd have wildly different interpretations of oceanic law involved. Both claim that it is their opponents who are acting dangerously and illegally. Here's Sea Shepherd director Paul Watson speaking to SBS News.
The Japanese are getting increasingly more violent and more aggressive. So we don't know how it's going to end, but we're not going to retreat. We're not going to surrender to their thuggery, really. They're down here illegally. They're killing whales illegally. And we're not here protesting. We're here trying to intervene against a poaching operation.
On the Japanese side, Fisheries Agency spokesperson Glenn Inwood had this interpretation for the Australian Broadcasting Corporation last week.
Puts the boat into full steam to try to cut the Shonan Maru off. You can see that the Shonan Maru is moving to the port to try to avoid a collision, and there's no avoiding the collision with the 80 Gill. It's a fast boat. She heads off full steam in front of it and miscalculates. So it's no wonder that it came to the grief that it has.
The goal of Sea Shepherd is to disrupt the hunt directly, but also to keep the issue on the front pages in the hope that a legal or diplomatic solution will be found. Last year, they prevented the Japanese from taking half their quota, or about 500 whales. Furthermore, they publicised the issue by producing a highly successful television series called Whale Wars. For lovers of reality television out there, here's what the promo sounds like.
Whaling ends today. Friday, June 5th at 9. Whale Wars, only on Animal Planet.
But let's not get carried away. The group has also been the target of considerable criticism, and not only from the whalers themselves. Greenpeace, which also engaged in direct anti-whaling action prior to ending their operations in 2008, has accused Sea Shepherd of endangering lives. That must sting, given that Canadian Paul Watson, the founder and director of Sea Shepherd, was a founding member of Greenpeace also. He split to form Sea Shepherd after philosophical differences on how to take direct action. Hopefully with cooler heads, the Australian and New Zealand maritime authorities are also investigating the recent collision to determine who was at fault. Whether their findings will mean anything is yet to be seen, however, given how limited governmental oversight is in the far polar south.
You're listening to Terra Informa, a syndicated environmental news program produced at CJSR in Edmonton, Alberta. Stay tuned to CFRU 93.3 FM in Guelph.
But what does the law say about whaling? The industry is regulated by the International Whaling Commission, who uphold the current commercial whaling moratorium. However, there is a loophole. The Commission allows whaling for the purposes of scientific research. Although the research output from the whaling program is extremely limited, it provides a technically legal justification. This loophole cannot be closed without the support of three-quarters of the Whaling Commission. And given the strong diplomatic pressure applied to poorer member countries by Japan, it is unlikely this will be achieved anytime soon. Sea Shepherd claim that even if the technicalities of the law aren't behind them, the spirit of it is. So the drama continues, despite the loss of the Sea Shepherd's $2 million jet boat. For the Japanese fishing agency, it's a $70 million industry, not enough to break even, but perhaps enough to kickstart a dormant culinary tradition into a symbol of national pride once again. For the hard-headed ecologists, it's unlikely that the current kill of around 1,000 minke whales per year threatens the survival of the species. For the bigger species, which are occasionally targeted by the Japanese whalers, however, it's a different story. But moreover, the whaling issue in the Southern Ocean has stirred strong animal ethics sentiments in Western countries. Fleets of factory ships, spotting aircraft, and grenade-tipped harpoons versus a few lonely marine mammals in the hauntingly beautiful Southern Ocean does not sit well with many Westerners who hold whales in high regard. Given that both the Japanese fishing agency and the Sea Shepherd refuse to contemplate defeat, expect more drama this season. This is David Karchin for Terra Informa.
Thanks, Dave. I'm your host, Rebecca Rooney, and this is Terra Informa, your source for environmental news. For updates on breaking news throughout the week, check out our Facebook page or swing by our website at terrainforma.ca. Next up, we hear from Dr. David Schindler on his research into pollution from the tar sands industry. But first...
Hurry up, everyone. Get in the car. It's a long way to Kitimat.
All right. Shotgun.
Coming.
Right, so which one of you tree-hugging vegan hippies can actually drive?
I can ride a bike.
These IDs are good for driving.
Useless bunch of stoners. I'll do the driving then.
Thanks, Uncle Alex. Woohoo!
We've rounded up an award-winning team of crack Terra Informa journalists, and we're taking them 3,000 kilometers across Western Canada. We're following the route of one of Canada's most controversial environmental projects in decades, the multi-billion dollar Northern Gateway Pipeline.
We're speaking to people all along the way. We're talking oil, wilderness, jobs, politics, and money. Join us to find out why people are calling this project the environmental controversy of a lifetime.
And we want you to join us on our radio adventure.
Yeah! Woohoo! We'll be broadcasting in-depth reports from Northern British Columbia in August and September. So tune in this time each week on your local community radio station.
Alex! GPS says go left!
Stop poking me!
On the road again with Terra Informa.
That's right. Terra Informa is going to hit the road again this summer. We hope you'll keep tuning in to hear the stories we uncover as we follow the proposed route of the Northern Gateway Pipeline. As you heard during the news segment at the top of the show, the federal government has just released its proposed environmental monitoring plan for the tar sands. The plan may have been developed in less than a year, but for critics of the industry, it has been a long time coming. For years, scientists and environmental groups have heaped criticism on the monitoring systems tasked with overseeing the tar sands industry. Last fall, the release of two reports by renowned ecologist Dr. David Schindler marked a tipping point. They clearly linked pollution of the Athabasca watershed to tar sands extraction, a claim both industry and the Alberta government had long denied. For some insight into the work that got it all rolling, here's Dr. David Schindler speaking about his research last fall.
We actually studied 31 different elements in this study. We chose to report only 13 here because We had to cut this considerably to meet the journal's maximum length requirements. And this made a good story because these are all elements that are known to be toxic at very low concentrations, which is why they're on the US EPA's priority pollutant list. And the analyses, contrary to some of the other sampling programs and monitoring programs that have been done, were done by certified laboratories. The metals were done by Queen's University and the Royal Military College, which were among the best laboratories in the country for those sorts of analyses. The reasons for this study, looking at the review of the Regional Aquatic Monitoring Program in 2004, done by three prominent federal civil servants, it's about 100 pages, about 99 is scathing criticism, and there have been objections to what RAMP has been doing several times since. So that was one stimulus. The second was in 2007, after EcoJustice won its famous court case, Environment Canada was forced to make public the results in its national pollutant release inventory, which is what industry itself reports that it releases. And we plotted those data up and were, once we did, we started following very avidly how much those industries were belching out and how rapidly they were increasing. So we figured there's no way industry can be belching out hundreds of kilograms of toxins every year and this not be detectable in the environment, unless the monitoring program is totally incompetent. Now, what we set out to do was to deliberately test this claim that all of the pollutants in the river are natural. And to do that, we first used GIS mapping to map the extent of the McMurray Formation, which is the formation that is bearing all of this bitumen. And then we carefully set out a grid of samples, starting down here at the bottom, which is upstream, upstream of Fort McMurray, and going down right to the Delta and Lake Athabasca, and also on every tributary that is coming in. Most of the tributaries were developed. We managed to find a few that weren't, so we could also examine whether these simply increased going downstream or whether industrial development was responsible. So the claims by the government spokespeople that that we didn't design this study properly are absolutely untrue. We found that in almost every case, downstream of industry was where the highest concentrations were. In the same study, we sampled snow at the end of winter in March of 2008 for a radius going upstream and downstream up to 200 kilometers between Fort McMurray and the Lake Athabasca, and the width of our grid was about 75 kilometers. At sites near to development, this being again the Muskeg River, snow was visibly contaminated. You can see here the black lines that indicate deposition events when the wind blows from that direction. We took samples of the complete snowpack and we melted them. And just to give you a comparison, this sample, these are all in stainless steel pots to melt the snow. This is a pristine site. You can see a nice clean water sample. This one was taken from AR6 next to the upgraders. There's visible oil floating on the water, and you can see that you can't even see the bottom of the pot because of the high particulates in there. Now, this is why we would have expected this. This is the National Pollutant Research Inventory. These are data right from Environment Canada's website. These are not part of the paper. But note that the output of mercury in this case, that industry is reporting itself, gone up threefold from 2005 to 2008, and it's going up at an exponential rate. Same thing for lead, threefold again, and the increase for arsenic has a slightly different pattern, but it's up threefold between 2002, and for some reason 2008 was not reported yet. So industry itself is reporting these huge increases. Why would anyone in his right mind expect that these are not increasing on the river and that these are undetectable? Turning to river water, you can see that the highest concentrations always occur near development. They don't continuously increase down the river as the government spokespeople are claiming. They claim that they'll just increase going downstream because as water moves downstream, it's exposed to more and more of this natural bitumen. It's not the case. The levels stay high. Some of that may be due to natural sources, but the big inputs are right around development. All of this is in clear violation of the Fisheries Act. The Fisheries Act is not based on amounts released or concentrations in the river. It just says flatly that there will be no deposition of any deleterious substance to a river or to near enough to a river to get into it, period. Environment Canada is the agency that is supposed to enforce that Section 36, subsection 3 of the Fisheries Act. So you have to ask, where is Environment Canada on all of this? So, just to give you an overall summary, none of the drinking water guidelines were violated in this study, though I expect that if we were to sample right at spring snowmelt, some might have been. That's one period that needs thorough investigation. The Canadian Council of Ministers of the Environment have guidelines for protection of aquatic life, and they were violated for several of these elements that we measured. And the Alberta Environment Surface Water Quality Guidelines were violated for a few as well. Water and snow from background sites were over some guidelines, but in impacted sites, the exceedances were larger and for more of these toxic elements. So, and fewer guidelines were surpassed in winter, probably because part of the pollution, the airborne part, was kept out of the river, and of course the watersheds are frozen on the surface, so anything getting into the river or its tributaries at that point would be via groundwater. Both air and water inputs are occurring, and they are in clear violation of the Fisheries Act. They're over guidelines for protection of aquatic life, particularly near and downstream of industry. And this indicates that monitoring in that system, it really is not very competent right now. We really need a better monitoring program followed by scientific peer review of the data, not as we have now a database that is considered to be proprietary and the government says, oh, well, our data refute everything that you have. Peer review in and publication in good scientific journals is the earmark of good science, and it's what most countries in the first world use as the basis for policy. What we have going on right now is innuendo versus propaganda. So there is very little science in the background. And I'm hoping that we'll contribute to making some sense of what's happening.
That was Dr. David Schindler speaking last fall. Dr. Schindler is a professor of ecology at the University of Alberta, and his work has been widely used in formulating ecologically sound management policies in Canada, the U.S., and Europe. That wraps things up for this week's show. I've been your host, Rebecca Rooney. Technical production is by Mike McNichol, and you can reach us by emailing tara@cjsr.com. Thanks for listening, and tune in again next week.